From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, things could be looking up for songwriters in the age of streaming services. Plus, comedian and former YouTube star Bo Burnham has written and directed a movie exploring his conflicted feelings about the internet. It's called Eighth Grade, and the lead is a 13-year-old girl.
I was very interested in young people vlogging about their own life, and I watched hundreds and hundreds of videos, and not to be cruel to the boys, but on average, the boys of this age talked about Xbox, and the girls this age talked about their souls.
And a movie about a Filipino-American family that subverts stereotypes. All that coming right up. Songwriters who have struggled in the era of streaming now may have cause to celebrate. The advent of platforms like Spotify, Apple Music, and Pandora radically increased our access to music, but had a drastic and largely negative impact on the people who actually make the songs that we stream. Michelle Lewis and Kay Hanley write songs for a living, and in the past, songwriters could make ends meet from the earnings from physical sales of albums, cassettes, or CDs, known as the mechanical licenses. But in the streaming era, it has become much more difficult to get by because those transactions are not considered physical sales. Lewis and Hanley wrote and recorded a song in 2016 called Gently Down the Stream. It was written to raise awareness of the issues they and other songwriters faced.
Sold CDs, then MP3s, then suddenly it's free. 0.00208 of a penny's what a songwriter makes.
Together, Lewis and Hanley formed the group Songwriters of North America to advocate for change, updating old copyright laws to bring songwriters a bigger slice of the streaming pie. With representatives from the music industry, they helped lobby for the Music Modernization Act. The bill passed the House in April and just recently passed the Senate Judiciary Committee. When we spoke today, we talked about what's covered in the bill and why song streams have been so hard to monetize.
What is a stream? It's not a rental. It's not mechanical.
It's not a physical purchase of a CD.
Exactly.
But then again, it's all of these things.
It's not
an apples to apples. It's not even an apples to oranges. It's a whole new fruit.
It's a weird fruit.
Yeah.
And what does that mean in terms of how artists are and are not paid? Because I suspect that musicians, as composers and as performers, start talking and they all figure out they're really not getting anything. Who has it hurt the most?
It's hurt the middle class of musicians, songwriters, and artists the most, because songwriters are behind the curtains. We're like the screenwriters. You know, we don't have that brand name recognition.
Most of us. Especially the middle class.
Yeah.
So not middle class performers, but Tom Petty, Stevie Nicks, and more, the publisher representing their music, mm-hmm. sued Spotify for the tidy sum of $1.6 billion for failing to license music properly. How does that litigation overlap with what you are trying to do?
Oh, that's such a good question. That's a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
That could actually put a company like Spotify out of business. And they're suing them for infringement. Basically, digital service providers like Spotify, Pandora, Apple, some of them maybe just missed licensing some copyrights properly. I'll give them the benefit of the doubt and just say they sort of missed it. That means that they're liable for infringement. So the publishers have brought all these, and some songwriters like David mm-hmm. Lowery and Melissa Ferrick have brought these huge lawsuits, infringement lawsuits, onto the digital service providers. The digital service providers, I think, ultimately threw their hands up and they were like, okay, uncle, we need to figure something out. And that was the sort of piece that brought them to the table to start negotiating the Music Modernization Act, which is the legislation that we have in the House, actually in the Senate.
The Music Modernization Act has passed the Senate Judiciary Committee, has yet to be voted on by the full Senate.
Yes.
If it becomes law, mm-hmm. what will change? Who will it benefit? And how quickly will songwriters and maybe even performers start to see a difference in the royalty checks they're getting?
It's a raise for us, for sure. What it does ostensibly is loosen some of the regulations on the performance side that we've talked about, sort of makes the rate court proceedings more fair, brings us closer to like a free market negotiation. And then on the mechanical side, which we've discussed what a mechanical is, the sales side. Well, first of all, what I say, what I think the modernization piece of the Music Modernization Act is bringing a mechanical right into a stream.
Right.
Right. So it codifies
it kind of enshrines and codifies that there is actually a tiny little piece of a mechanical in a stream.
There's always been a lot of mystery about what the true economics of streaming services are.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
When you and your colleagues have looked at Spotify's numbers, what surprised you? What did you learn? And what did it tell you about what needed to be fixed?
In a way, I think this legislation almost saves Spotify. You know, the consumers made the choice. This is how we want to consume music. This is the way. And rather than fight that and continue to sue them, put them out of business, we are being collaborative with them to fix it. In a lot of ways, it's data fixing. It's making sure that all the metadata that is associated with a copyright, like who wrote it, who the publisher is, what the splits are, making sure that's all correct, and making sure that the DSPs have it. Digital service providers have it, and anyone who wants that information can get it. And that will actually help them.
Everybody.
Right, because then they won't be infringing as easily.
Right. So like a lot of legislation, the Music Modernization Act probably is imperfect, but it also has to appeal and gain support from so many different constituencies.
Right.
Artists, record labels, streaming services, music publishers.
Yeah.
Do you think everybody is unhappy enough, meaning that everybody gave up a little something to get what they
wanted? That's a great way to put it. Broadcasters, even, who are historically skeptical of any of these kind of consensus around, you know, how music is going to be consumed and licensed in the future, even they were like, what was the word that they used? They were positively neutral.
Positively.
That was the word. That's the word that they used in Congress. Positively neutral, meaning they weren't going to fight it.
Michelle and Kay, thanks for coming back in.
Thanks for having us.
Michelle Lewis and Kay Hanley are songwriters and activists. Coming up, comedian and filmmaker Bo Burnham has channeled some deep thoughts about our relationship to the internet in his first feature film. It's called Eighth Grade. The comedian Bo Burnham made it big on the internet as a teenager with YouTube videos like this one from 2008, which has nearly 29 million views.
B.O. lingers and it makes you think, cause I'm Bo, yo. And I'm the greatest rapper ever, and I'll weather your weather, whether you think I'm clever or not. Think you're better, you're not. Don't need a sweater, I'm hot. You got two eyes, only got one shot. Yeah.
Now, Bo Burnham is 27 years old, and he's also a filmmaker. His movie Eighth Grade is about a 13-year-old girl named Kayla who makes self-help videos from her bedroom, only she doesn't get nearly the kinds of views that Burnham once enjoyed. Kayla is played by newcomer Elsie Fisher, and the movie immerses you in her point of view. In one scene, she's lying in bed, scrolling through Instagram while an Enya song plays in the background. It's oddly mesmerizing. When I met Bo Burnham after Eighth Grade premiered at the Sundance Film Festival earlier this year, he told me how he wrote to Enya asking to license her song for his movie.
I was like, do I write a note on like a salmon and put it in the Euphrates? Like, how do you contact, like, how do you get to Enya? Like, do I like release a smoke signal in the air? But I wrote a letter telling her what it meant to me, what it meant to the movie, and the price came down.
What did the song mean to you? I'm curious.
It meant something. I don't know. It was a certain portrayal of what I felt like it means to browse on the internet. That the internet is something strange and almost spiritual. I wanted it to feel sensory and deep.
But it's also like this kind of river of images. Like,
yeah,
she's talking about sailing away,
yeah,
or an ocean
of
images, whatever the water metaphor.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the sort of ideas that, like, the kids have a choice in their bed every day. They can look at, like, the infinite amount of information in their pocket on their laptop, or they can look into the infinite blackness of their mind and their back of their eyelids. So, you know, that there really is, like, a choice between two, like, oblivions that is pretty ridiculous.
Did you set out to make a movie about eighth graders or the internet? Did one beget the other?
Definitely the internet. I set to make a story about how I was feeling, which is at the time I wrote the story, I was sort of coming to terms with the fact that I had anxiety and I felt like my feelings were tied in some way to the internet, and I wanted to talk about it. And my initial instinct was, okay, I have to write some big tandem narrative with 12 intersecting characters to get all these big ideas out. And then I stumbled on this voice, and I was like, I mean, I could say everything I want and more through her. That the sort of peripheral problems I have with the internet that exist around the core of my life, which is I have a job and I have to pay taxes. For a kid, it's everything.
What do you mean I stumbled on this voice? Was it somebody you heard yourself hearing? Is it somebody you saw doing YouTube videos?
I've always been interested in the YouTube videos that no one's watching. I've always been interested in people on the internet that are expressing themselves and no one's paying attention to, because the sort of narrative of the internet, we only ever talk about the people that go viral and the people that get paid attention to, but a majority of the internet are people calling out into a void and getting no answer.
Hey guys, Kayla back here with another video. Okay, so the topic of today's video is putting yourself out there. Okay, so like, what does that mean? Where is there? Well,
I was very interested in young people vlogging about their own life, and I watched hundreds and hundreds of videos, and not to be cruel to the boys, but on average, the boys of this age talked about Xbox, and the girls this age talked about their souls, you know, and I just think for whatever reason, if it's cultural pressure or whatever, girls are, I don't think it's just cultural, but I think girls are just a little deeper at that age and asking deeper questions of themselves.
Did you find that they were talking about their souls in an authentic way, or were they talking about their souls or themselves in a way that they thought other people would connect to? How much of it was kind of mediated by themselves in terms of the story they wanted to tell versus the story that was maybe truthful?
Yeah, well, I think all of it was mediated, and I think the actual story and the drama, hopefully the movie, is that mediation, is that exact thing, the want to articulate yourself, the sense that I am failing to be in command of my narrative in the way that most people that I see in movies that I like are, for example, you know, she wants to be the protagonist that has that perfectly articulate voiceover that describes her life, but she can't. And I think if we're being honest with ourselves, it's part of all of our pressures. I mean, am I not also here hoping I'm coming off as articulate and intelligent and sensitive? Of course I am. I'm mediating the way I'm being perceived all of the time. It's just the failure of our mediation is just so much more apparent when we're young, so we can kind of forgive ourselves a little more. But to me, it's, if I'm honest with myself, I'm asking the same questions. I'm trying to do the same things she is. I'm trying to be myself. I'm trying to put myself out there. I'm trying to be confident. All that.
But there's something that I think is particular to eighth grade that takes all of those issues and puts them under an unbelievable amount of pressure. I'm the parent of an eighth grader, so you're going through adolescence, so you're starting to think about sex and hormones and all those things are raging. You're about to enter high school, which is going to kind of maybe start you on a trajectory academically or professionally that you might not even have control over. And then relationships are forming between your peers that you can't quite control or understand.
Yeah, it's very – I always think it's like it's the most surreal social environment you are ever in at the most vulnerable time you ever are living. So it's like – and part of the movie is trying to hopefully discover these things like we're aliens seeing it for the first time. Like a pool party, why do we have these like young kids whose bodies are exploding in a pool of water, like clothed barely – like not clothed at all like they are in their normal lives. It just so the situations are very, very surreal. Oh, there's 100 kids in an auditorium and one standing up at a podium trying to keep – like I realized – I had a real appreciation for teachers realizing just how – and all educators – how chaotic school is. Like I saw the kids on set and I was like, oh, if you all just decided you could take this over, that the structure is sort of these like cultural norms are – barely hanging on, like, you know, as it is a really chaotic, strange time. So yes, I mean, that's what I talked about in terms of these feelings and worries are sort of fringe in my life, but It's almost like a drug experience being that age in terms of it being so sensory and just every tastes are more vivid and sounds are louder and things are brighter and the world is bigger. And that's what I wanted to feel like. I didn't want it to be a story that was remembered or nostalgic. I didn't want it to be polluted with my own memory or I want it to be felt in the moment viscerally.
We're talking with Bo Burnham. His new film is called Eighth Grade. I want to ask you about your creative collaboration with Elsa, your lead actress, and what she meant to you in terms of making sure that this story felt authentic to her. The way that kids like her talk, the things that they're uncomfortable talking about, the way she sees the world. How would you describe your partnership with her in telling this story?
I mean, like essential to the point where I feel like it was almost irresponsible that we greenlit the movie before we found her. Yeah, I mean, I told her every day, you know the truth of this more than anybody. I mean, my disconnect from you is twofold. I was never a 13-year-old girl, and I was never a 13-year-old right now. You are the only one on set that knows this. So you know the truth. This movie is coming to you, not the other way around. So there was a long rehearsal process, which was mostly for the script, mostly just to make sure that it sounded right. And if things didn't sound right, it was always the script's fault. So it's essential. You know, again, what I was trying to capture was what she was in many ways. So to have the real thing there, it's, you know, just completely subjugate myself to it.
How does social media affect a character like Kayla in this era that wouldn't have been true 20 years ago?
There's something about the internet and social media that I think forces kids to just kind of like atomizes themselves into you have the you living your life. You have the you watching yourself walk through your life. You have the you anticipating the next moment. You have the you anticipating the reaction to the next moment, watching people watch you, watching people watch you watch them. There's a really, really disorienting feeling, I think, to being alive right now in general. And it just especially affects kids that are vulnerable to it and too young to even realize it. But I don't know if any of us really have processed just how strange it is to be our own storytellers and not only have to live our life, but to have to curate our lives. And I think it's interpreted by older generations as narcissism, and it isn't. It's self-involved, but in a really sad way that is not fun. And it's a norm culturally. I mean, it's like not, you know, it's not like you can't really opt out of this stuff or then you're alone, you know. It's the weird oxymoron of the internet where it's like it's overstimulating and numbing, it's hyperconnective, and we're all super lonely.
So did it raise in your mind, the making of this film, more questions about how we process or unprocess all this stuff than it answered?
Well, I mean, from the process of writing, you know, I was certain that this movie was coming out in Hillary's America, first of all, you know, and then, you know, He Happened, which is, you know, a sort of, in my mind, a very sort of perfect summation of the internet in some weird way. So I don't. The world has gotten more confusing. Culture has gotten more strange. So I don't. But I have an emotional clarity through it with my collaboration with Elsie of just, you know, trusting myself and that at the end of the day these problems are personal and my real struggle is my own anxiety and my own feelings and calming down and getting out of my head. And the other stuff will sort itself out or it won't.
Bo, thanks so much for coming.
Thank you for having me.
Eighth Grade is in theaters on July 13th. Coming up, a new dark comedy shows a side of the Filipino-American family that's rarely, if ever, seen on screen.
KPCC supporters include Center Theater Group, presenting The Humans, Stephen Karam's 2016 Tony Award winner for Best Play. Charles McNulty of the Los Angeles Times said, The Humans has come to L.A. at full strength. If there's a better ensemble working in America right now than the extraordinary cast of The Humans at the Amundsen Theater, I'm unaware of its existence. The Humans, featuring the original Broadway company, only at the Amundsen, now through July 29th. More information at AmundsenTheater.org.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. Bitter Melon is a movie about a Filipino-American family that's loosely based on the real-life experiences of writer-director H.P. Mendoza. It's a dark comedy that's surprising and sometimes challenging to watch. This Friday, it screens at Outfest, but Frame contributor Paul Amardo got an early look at the film and brings us this story.
When my partner, Patrick Apino, told me he was going to be in a movie, I was excited. He's a writer, director, and actor, but this was personal. It's a film about people like us, sort of.
The film is called Bitter Melon. It's a tragic comedy.
In which a Filipino-American family conspires to kill a member who's been terrorizing them for years. He's named Troy.
And I play Troy.
Days before a sneak preview screening, I have to ask.
Do you feel any pressure at all?
Not pressure. I am a little anxious, to be honest. We'll see if I need to take several bathroom breaks during the screening.
Fast forward to preview night, and we're in a theater lobby in Hollywood. While Patrick calms his nerves and takes a bathroom break, I catch up with the film's writer-director.
Hi, my name is H.P. Mendoza, and I'm the director of Bitter Melon.
How are you feeling right now?
What adjective incorporates the word butterfly or butterflies? I'm butterflies-ish. How's that?
H.P.'s previous work includes the horror film I Am a Ghost and Coma, the musical. But Bitter Melon is his most personal project, and the title refers to ampalaya, a Philippine tropical vegetable with a bitter flavor. A fitting name for a film where characters act in ways that can be hard to swallow.
I do feel like it's a dark comedy because we are asking you to laugh at this really grotesque thing that happens, right? But we do honor the drama of it, so it is actually kind of sad.
Like a good Filipino family, Bitter Melon begins with a party. Declan Santos heads home to spend the holidays with his family in San Francisco. When he arrives, he's greeted by his brother Troy, who still lives at home.
Who the f*** is ringing the doorbell?
Sorry, we didn't know if anybody was home.
I'm just f***ing with you, man. What's up, Dad?
The family walks on eggshells around Troy. He physically abuses his wife and scares his daughter. Things are so bad that when Declan talks to his mom, he brings up an idea that could end his brother's reign of terror for good.
Why don't we kill Troy?
Declan, that's sick. How would we do it?
HP assures no real people were harmed in the making of this movie, but it is based on his real-life experiences and the characters modeled after his real family. He's been working on this for over 20 years, and his mother just recently gave her blessing to talk about the issues the film brings up, like the physical abuse she endured with HP's estranged father. Patrick's character, Troy, embodies a lot of their deep-rooted problems.
I like the fact that HP makes his own kinds of films, and I think he touches on things that a lot of Filipino families, a lot of Filipino-American families, too, don't talk about.
Like many Asian immigrant groups, Filipino-American families tend to sweep things under the rug. So when the characters in Bitter Melon do the opposite, it's cathartic, thrilling, sometimes confusing. HP says it's like when he first saw Better Luck Tomorrow.
I'll be completely honest, I was excited when Better Luck Tomorrow came out. I'm like, there's a Filipino lead character.
Four cheat sheets a day, the drugs, the scams. Between this and all my club commitments, I couldn't even start my homework until 1 a.m.
Directed by Fast and the Furious helmer Justin Lin, Better Luck Tomorrow is about a group of Asian American high school students breaking the law while keeping good grades.
Imagine growing up with that, right? And then suddenly being confronted with this movie where you have a bunch of Filipinos. Your mind goes places while you're watching it. There are side characters, but the leads are also Filipino. I don't know what to do with that. And then on top of that, there are no model minorities.
HP faced challenges making a film with Asian American actors who didn't portray stereotypes like the overachieving model minority. At test screenings, one person said the cast all looked the same, so he couldn't tell them apart. Another suggested recasting the whole thing.
I know you're saying this is a Filipino-American story, but there's nothing specifically Filipino-American about it. Have you considered shooting this movie with regular people?
This reminds me of what happened in 2002, when Better Luck Tomorrow had its premiere at the Sundance Film Festival. During the Q&A, an audience member asked if it was irresponsible to portray Asian Americans negatively. The late film critic Roger Ebert got up to respond. Here's some tape from that moment.
And what I find very offensive and condescending about your statement
is nobody would say to a bunch of white filmmakers, how could you do this to your people?
Yeah.
This film has the right to be about these people, and Asian American characters have the right to be whoever the hell they want to be. They do not have to represent their people.
That legendary moment helped launch Justin Lin's career. But in 2018, Asian Americans are still subject to stereotypes. Now Bittermelon is subverting them. After the screening, audience members trickle into the lobby to greet Patrick.
So much love for you, man.
Dude, appreciate that.
And to chat with HP.
Being a Filipino American myself, it was just a breath of fresh air to see my family on screen and to see a character that is Filipino-American specific that I can relate to. It's about damn time.
Overall, the screening went really well. Sure, I'm a little biased, but I've watched Patrick work on this since he first got the script over a year ago. When I check in with HP the next day, he says the most important feedback he's received has been from the Filipino-American community.
I know I want everyone to be moved, but there's something special knowing the Filipino Americans are like, no, but there's a little something here, like you actually get this. I like being told by quote-unquote my people that I get it.
Turns out that night was just a taste of what was to come. A week later, Bittermelon premiered to sold-out crowds in Oakland and San Francisco, and it's making stops in New York and LA. With some luck, it'll be in theaters soon. For KPCC's The Frame, I'm Paula Mardo.
Bittermelon screens July 13th at OutFest. The LGBTQ Film Festival runs from July 12th to the 22nd. And that is it for today. The Frame is back tomorrow. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us.